For the week of March 4th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 402, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Alabama for the moment, I'm Michael Gills.
You're in Alabama for the moment, of course, because you're headed to Washington, D.C., where you will be working as what? In the White House doing what? Any number of jobs since they can't
Communications director.
Yes, exactly.
No, I was in Atlanta over the weekend at my friend's great restaurant, Petit Chou, Little Cabbage in Cabbage Town in Atlanta. If you're there, go check it out. Now I'm back in Birmingham. Tomorrow I head to Nashville and then Allentown, Pennsylvania, and then back to New York City. Next week's show, I'll probably be in Allentown and then right after that into the city.
Well, we have something having to do with the New York Post. I wonder if you're going to try out for a particular job, but we can kind of get to that later.
Yeah, well, you're talking about Michael Riedel from the New York Post. He's moving on to a new job, and he's probably got a little time on his hands. Maybe he's got a day or two off in between gigs. So while he's catching up on his podcast and he's listening to Showbiz Sandbox, what will he hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we will celebrate the High Holy Day, also known as the Oscars. We'll complain that some films won which shouldn't have, while other films lost when they should have won. We'll also have our friend Ann Thompson of IndieWire joining us to share insights a lot smarter than those. A low bar, but she'll clear it easily. We'll also take a quick glance at the César and Spirit Awards, because in about a week, we'll forget this year's winners and start talking about next year's Oscar hopefuls. That probably won't include Black Panther. It is a comic book movie, after all. But the Marvel flick continues to set records at the worldwide box office. During Book Filter, Michael will tout the breaking news that women have gained the right to vote thanks to a last-minute victory in Tennessee. Wait, what? What? Okay.
They did.
Okay. Well, in Sexual Misconduct, we'll offer up a rundown of all the interviews E! Wouldn't carry live on the air. Just kidding. Actually, we share the factoid we promised to cover last week but failed to do because we're sexist. Sorry, ladies. On Inside Baseball, Comcast says, hey, wait a minute. We want to bid on Sky 2. Then all hell breaks loose. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter. You are listeners. But everyone knows the answer to this question. What is the number one movie in the world? It is Black Panther. You knew that even if you just watched the Oscars. $120 million over the weekend. It's just at $900 million worldwide and obviously still going strong. It's an amazingly popular film.
Get this, the movie made this past weekend, third weekend in theaters, okay? $65 million, $65.7 million in North America alone. That is a great opening weekend.
Well, not if a movie costs $200 million, it's not. But yes, it's a great third weekend. It's one of the highest of all time. I think one of the Star Wars may have beaten it or one of the Avengers, but it's moving right up into the top 10 of all time in all sorts of categories. Certainly in North America, it's going to pass the $1 billion mark. So it's going to be in that august, you know, company worldwide, and it's still going strong. So,
well, I know you hate qualifiers, but I believe it has become the highest grossing Marvel film of all time in North America. In North America.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
I don't think so. No, it's in the top 10 and it may pass one of the Avengers, but I think it's got a little bit ways to go and it certainly could be. But yeah, who would have predicted that in advance? Not me. So that's pretty amazing. That is the number one film around the world, but there are a lot of other movies. China's still in the afterglow of its new year when lots of big movies open up. And the number two film is Operation Red Sea, a fist-pumping patriotic film, $62 million on the weekend, $475 million worldwide. Number three is the Jennifer Lawrence thriller Red Sparrow, $43 million on its opening weekend, and kind of mixed reviews. We'll have to see how it holds out. But the budget, somebody reported the budget of this film was $69 million, which makes it sound like it's on sale or something. $69.99. It's like, no. $70 million. Just round it up, people. Come on. $69 million. It's $70 million. At number four is Detective Chinatown 2, $32 million on the weekend. That's at $500 million worldwide. Below that is Peter Rabbit, another $25 million for the family-friendly movie, and that passed the $100 million mark. So that should get to $150 million, which means it will have tripled the budget that has been reported in the media. So it should be okay, especially since what happens with family films?
Well, they tend to go on to be DVDs, Blu-rays, and streaming, and so they have great ancillary legs.
Yeah, they have better legs than other categories. In general, is that still true? I assume it is.
Oh, let me tell you something. Yes, it is.
Because you've watched Frozen yet again.
Yes, I have.
At number six is Game Night, another $20 million on the weekend. That's at $50 million worldwide. Then there's 50 Shades Freed, the finale to the naughty, sexy, romantic drama, $14 million on the weekend, $350 million worldwide. Then there's a new film starring Bruce Willis called Death Wish. When I saw Black Panther, they had a trailer for Death Wish. I kind of immediately got uncomfortable. I'm like, Death Wish is the nastiest, most sort of retrograde, ugly, nihilistic movie where, like, all the criminals are, you know, you got this white man shooting down all these people, you know. And so I thought, oh, dear me. And I watched the trailer, and like, Bruce Willis was hitting on all the white people. Every single person he fought was, I don't know whether it's the editing in the trailer for putting it behind Black Panther or whether that's what the movie does, but they were very careful not to show him, you know, shooting down all the criminals. So it was all white people all the time as far as who he was gunning at. But it's Death Wish. Why the heck would you want to remake that Charles Bronson film? It's a really ugly, nasty movie. $13 million on the weekend. Didn't do great. Mostly watched, dominated by older white men. So it's sort of like the Fox News audience turned out for Death Wish. We'll have to see if it has legs. At number nine is a film, a French comedy. I should have looked up what it means in English. I forgot to look it up. De Jolie Chutet Family. I don't know what that means. But it made $11 million on its opening weekend. It stars Danny Boone, who named himself after Daniel Boone. I don't know how he chose that name, but he did. But it's this broad family comedy where he plays a hotshot architect who's ashamed of his working class roots. And number 10 is The Shape of Water, the Oscar winner for Best Picture. Another $10 million on the weekend, $125 million worldwide. Then another film below that, just opening up in China. This came out in 2015 and played most of the world. It's even aired on Indian TV, where it was the highest rated movie playing on television of all time. It's called Brother Bajranji, or in Hindi, Bajranji Bhaijaan. Oh, golly, I messed that up. It's a sentimental comic drama starring Salman Khan. It's become a huge star in China. And they said, hey, let's get that movie out there in China. It made $8 million on its opening weekend. It's at $109 million worldwide.
Well, it just goes to show you that, you know, everybody kind of faults China for piracy. I guess they didn't pirate that.
Yeah, I guess they didn't realize he was going to be such a big star.
Right.
They did probably pirate Monster Hunt 2. That's at $8 million on the weekend, clearly fading fast compared to the other two big winners from that holiday weekend, Operation Red Sea and Detective Chinatown 2. But, you know, it's made its money back hand over fist, so it's fine. It's at $350 million worldwide. Then there's another sequel out in China. It's called Girls vs. Gangsters. It's a sequel to a movie called Girls, which I think we covered about 4 years ago. The sequel is sort of a cross between Sex and the City, it's all girl power, and The Hangover, because they go out on a big night on the town and have crazy antics, and they're like, are we wanted by the police? You know, they see a poster for themselves as wanted figures. It's fun, light comedy. Mike Tyson even shows up, which frankly isn't that funny, but it made $8 million on its opening weekend. Then there's The Greatest Showman, another Oscar nominee. It didn't win any Oscars, did it? It lost to Coco, as it should have, for Best Song. But The Greatest Showman made $8 million on the weekend. It's at $375 million worldwide. Then Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which won at least two awards, Best Actress and Best Supporting Actor. That's at $130 million worldwide. Then there's Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, $930 million worldwide. It probably is just about done. It's probably going to end up at $950 million, maybe at the most. So just a little bit below $1 billion. But boy, that movie was a big success story. And at number 17 is The Princess and the Matchmaker. This is a South Korean romantic comedy. It's a period story about a princess who refuses the four compatible suitors that she's offered and flees the palace to find true love. That made $5.8 million on its opening weekend. And there's Annihilation, hits $20 million.
Have you noticed something about Annihilation? If you look at it, there is no international growth whatsoever.
It hasn't opened yet in any other territory.
It won't, because actually Paramount sold it to Netflix.
That's right. They sold it to Netflix. Well, the movie cost roughly $40 million. I wonder what Netflix paid for it.
I don't know.
And whether that looks like a good bargain. Given the fact that it's sort of underperforming in North America, they might feel like they made the right choice.
Yeah, well,
you know, instead of selling it off, this is, you know, it's similar to what happens a lot in the old days. Studios would sell off a piece of the movie. They'd say, all right, we'll keep domestic and sell off the rights to other territories, to other people, and get back their money before the movie even opened and feel safe. Now, the bigger and bigger movies get, it just becomes dumb. If you're willing to make a $150 million movie, you're going to have it make money worldwide, and therefore, why sell off the rights? But for a smaller film like this, sort of going back to the old days, instead of selling it to some local distributor or some local whatever, they're selling it to Netflix, who says, all right, we'll take it for the rest of the world.
You know, you're saying going back to the old days, whereas there are studio executives going, I found this great new way to finance movies.
Well, there are other Oscar hopefuls on the list here. Lady Bird is about to hit $60 million. The Post hit $150 million. And while John Williams didn't win an Oscar for his work on any feature film, he did sort of help get the best animated short over the top, because he got a shout out from Kobe Bryant for his score for that basketball short. The Maze Runner hit $280 million worldwide. Clint Eastwood's movie 1517 to Paris, that hit $50 million worldwide. And there's one more new movie. It's called Little Forest. It's a South Korean drama based on a manga of the same name about a young woman who leaves the city and returns to her home in the countryside. That opened somewhat modestly at $4.1 million.
And that's in 22nd place. I'm not downgrading. I'm just saying, just to let
our listeners. Yeah, I sort of try to downplay the ranking because it doesn't really matter, because some movies are opening in four territories, others are already in 80 territories and are already played out. So where they list on the ranking, it's never a straightforward comparison. Whenever you say number two at the box office in North America, well, maybe it's been out for 30 weeks, so number two is great. You know, whereas you might say, oh, it lost out, it's not number one. So those rankings really don't matter. So I sort of don't hit on them a lot. I try to sort of avoid it.
Well, this is, you know, hearing from a couple of listeners, this is what it does help do, is that when you say number like 18, Annihilation, and it made $5.6 million worldwide, really in the U.S. alone, as we just mentioned, it kind of signals to some, oh, well, okay, if you're at 18 and at 5.6, that kind of gives you some level as to the entire box office and where things might stand for that particular weekend.
Right. Okay, well, I'll keep that in mind. Maybe I'll start to do it a little bit more again. But yeah, the worldwide box office, you can get onto the top 25 if you just make a couple million dollars. So, you know, the 25th film is Early Man by Nick Park, that animated stop motion film. $3.1 million on the weekend. That's at $36 million worldwide. So you could get into our top 25 just by scoring a couple million dollars. So if you see a film in France or Sweden or Somalia or anywhere in the world, Brazil, that has grossed $3 million or more on its weekend, and it's not on this list, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or you can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
That's right. And two of the Chinese films we mentioned, Operation Red Sea and Detective Chinatown 2, those are going to be ranking among the biggest Chinese films of all time. They're already in the top 10. They're both about to hit the top three. They'll both probably pass The Mermaid, which was the second highest grossing Chinese film of all time with $537 million. Number one is Wolf Warrior 2, which we talked about a lot. That's at $850 million. Detective Chinatown 2 and that other film are going to come right up there. Maybe they'll probably blow past The Mermaid. And Detective Chinatown 2, I want to mention again, because it's the first Chinese film to shoot in New York City with a union crew. So maybe some earlier films picked up a few scenes, but this film was based in New York City mostly. I mean, they went all over the city, the public library, the statue, Grand Central Station. They were all over the city. And so it really was a New York film. And sort of that was one of the lures during the holiday season for Chinese filmgoers. They got to sort of visit New York. And the next film is going to, first one was Tokyo. This one is New York. Where's the next one go to? I forget what the city is that they just announced where it would head to. But you probably know that anyway. But these movies move around all the time. And we talk about China a lot. We know that Black Panther opens in China on Friday. I wonder if movies open on Thursday nights in China. And we also know that Xi Jinping is going to be president when the sequel to Black Panther opens up, because they've sort of gotten rid of the rules, or they're getting rid of the rules, and he will be president for life. So he's basically going to be a dictator for life in that country. You know, we don't talk about politics a lot, but I think you and I sort of have been seeing China and thinking it's getting more and more commercial. There's more and more capitalism. You've got these cities where capitalism flourishes. You've got a sense of the rule of law a little bit more, with an independent judiciary and people owning real estate a little bit. And you felt like it was a nascent and growing more and more. Maybe there's going to be more push for maybe other parties and speaking out and freedom of the press. And this is a real step backwards. And will that affect Hollywood?
Yeah. And in fact, it's funny you should mention that. That is exactly what the article in the New York Times, the Sunday New York Times, was saying. Is, as much as Europe was saying, well, I guess if the U.S. isn't going to be a political leader, a worldwide political leader, maybe the, you know, China will step forward. Whoa, what's going on over there? You know, it was very quick for them to immediately turn to Xi Jinping as maybe for the next 5 years being the leader to set the tone, to actually putting pause on that for a moment.
Yeah, it has to give, you know, companies want to make money. It's a big market, but it just suddenly got a little bit more complicated. So it sounds a little silly, but in fact, over the weekend, they sort of banned Winnie the Pooh from the internet, at least in China. Why? Because she had been compared to Winnie the Pooh in a lovable terms, like, oh, he's our lovable leader, like Winnie the Pooh, which is an odd comparison. Nonetheless, that had sort of stuck around for a while. So when people wanted to protest Xi's seizing of power like this, they were using images of Winnie the Pooh in negative ways. And so the government said, can't use Winnie the Pooh. They also had to get rid of the letter N for similar reasons, where they were saying N is greater than two, meaning, you know, Xi thinks he's more important than term limits and can crush it. And so I forget how N links to Xi, whether it's N as an emperor or something else. But they said, nah, you can't use the letter N. I don't know how you could ban that from the internet, at least in China. But that's what they've been doing. So obviously there's not a lot of free speech in the country. A lot of people have, just as in Russia, people are imprisoned, people are jailed, people disappear. There's a one party control of the media. So it's a country where you want to do business. It's a huge market. Hollywood isn't going to stop going there, but it suddenly got a little bit trickier.
That's true. Same with, you know, using your movie pass here in the United States to see a movie. Well, at least Red Sparrow. If you wanted to see Red Sparrow this weekend in most LA theaters, well, you couldn't, because they took the film off of their service. Now, they're claiming that this was just a test. They were testing something out in just one market, kind of like an A-B test. There is some speculation now that this wasn't a test. This was an accident. This was a bug in which something was checked off as not being available, that it was a 3D film when it wasn't a 3D film in those theaters here in Los Angeles. But that said, it annoyed MoviePass users. I was at the theater over the weekend and I saw a number of people using MoviePass. So this is anecdotally, and they were all over the age of probably 60.
Really?
Yes. I thought the same. I was like, really? Wow. Okay.
Yeah, well, our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, went to see Red Sparrow and got frustrated. And so he found three small mom-and-pop chains that had the film in all of L.A. They were the only ones. And he went to the Saturday 8:45 screening, and it was sold out when he got a ticket. But in fact, the theater ended up being sold out. He also spoke to somebody who works at a major L.A. theater chain, a major spot. I won't say which one, but that person claims that the phone number that MoviePass provides to theater chains to reach them directly, not the one for the public, but for one for the professionals, is just as bad as the one that the consumers use. It's like almost impossible to get someone on the line and speak to an actual human. So is it growing pains, or are they just saying, I thought maybe the LA thing was them trying to see, hey, if we just don't let you see the biggest movie on opening weekend, will you go see something else?
Well,
they
were marketing Death Wish. So they were being paid to market Death Wish. So,
right.
But you know, doing it one market alone doesn't really help necessarily, unless they're just doing an A-B test and really just trying to figure out, gee, in this market, if we if we take one movie away, does Death Wish do better? And they can then go back and figure it out. You know, was it a bug in the code? Maybe. I will say this. Today, this morning, they announced that they hired a head of customer support, and they plan on doing quite a lot of hiring. They just announced that.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, we know that they're having trouble, and we know that most of their users are in big cities like New York and LA.
That's correct.
People said, hey, guess what? MoviePass is cheaper than a single ticket. So it seems pretty compelling if you pay $15 for a movie ticket to get MoviePass for $10. Most people don't go to one movie a month, but nonetheless, the very first one you buy is cheaper than what you would pay. That makes it really easy to say yes, as opposed to here in Birmingham, where if you go to matinee or things, I went to see a movie that was $5. You know, there's lots of movies that aren't necessarily $10 first time out. Some are, but most aren't. So I think the message of MoviePass is people like the idea of a subscription, certain art and film goers, and ticket prices in New York and LA are too high. Is that possible? Because when I come to another part of the country, I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I'm living it up. $8, $9 to see a movie, matinees, I'm thrilled. And I know real estate is a lot more expensive in the big city, so they charge a higher price. But you want to go to a movie every week, $15 is a lot.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is.
But will it be too much for Avengers Infinity Wars? They just moved up the release date 1 week. They're opening it now on April 27th. It's going to be worldwide day and date. I thought, are they eyeing a record? Do they want bragging rights? No movies were really opening to May 4th. And now they're a week earlier. So, you know, the summer movie season, you know, big movies in February. Now they're moving up into April. And somebody said, well, you know, it's really something to do with China. They always sort of opened a week earlier in some Asian territories to fight off counterfeiting and piracy. I'm not quite sure how that helps.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Well, I guess maybe if they're opening day and date around the world, you know, it definitely cuts down on piracy. So if they're opening April 27th in China, then yes, it would help.
Well, no, but the point was, yeah, they tended to open up a week early in those territories. And now they just said, oh, heck, let's just move it up. Let's just do everybody the same date. You know, they were always going to open up a week early in China to beat piracy and India. So that's why they were opening up in April 27th in those territories. And maybe Black Panther had them say, you know what? We don't need to wait till May. It used to be we had to wait till, you know, Memorial Day. Now they're like, what the heck? Let's just open it April 27th.
Well, what I would do is I would look at what Disney has coming out after Avengers and see how far back that is, because what they may not want to do is remove their track from a theater. And what I mean by that is very often circuits, movie theater chains will look at a studio and say, okay, you've got two screens, you've got two tracks in my complex in Century City, Los Angeles, and you can replace one movie with the other. It doesn't happen as much anymore, but so you don't want to step on yourself, basically.
So you're saying if they had another big movie opening up 2 weeks later or earlier,
right, exactly,
that might...
Exactly. So they might be trying to get out of the way.
They would have known that already, though.
Yes, I don't know why they would move it up so late in the game.
No, yeah, I don't think that doesn't sound like the reason. I think maybe it's just as much as anything, they said, hey, let's just have that biggest number of all time worldwide. Why wait a week? We don't need to wait a week. There's a big audience waiting in February. There's a big audience in March. There's a big audience in April. So they don't need to wait until the summer season. The summer season is now starting in the spring.
Well, spring might just be starting, Michael, but it is the end of award season. And for us here at Showbiz Sandbox, there is nobody we love talking to more than Ann Thompson, IndieWire's editor-at-large. In fact, as some of our listeners reminded us over the past week, no Oscar season is complete until we officially hear what Ann has to say about this year's ceremony and all the winners. So here to help us pick apart last night's Academy Awards and officially start next year's Oscar race, Ann Thompson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. It wouldn't be the same without you.
Of course, we had two big awards right before the Oscars. At the Césars, they chose one of my favorite films of the year, BPM. And then at the Spirit Awards, which you get to attend, it was Get Out was the big winner. And people got sort of excited. They thought, oh my gosh, is this it? Is it going to happen? Did you have fun at the Spirit Awards?
I always have fun. It's my peeps. It's my world, even if it's freezing under that tent in Santa Monica. But basically what I was happy that Get Out got a chance to, you know, bask in the glory and that Greta Gerwig got to win something. It was really great to share the love there. And Agnes Varda got to win. So in the end, even though I figured at the Oscars with Three Billboards and Shape of Water not in the running for the spirits, Get Out would have a tougher time. If that made any sense.
And do you think sometimes that the Spirit Awards is kind of like the, well, if you win at the Spirit Awards, you know, except for you're probably not going to win at the Oscars.
No, it's not like that. What's really remarkable is that they've had a string of predictive winners from The Artist and 12 Years a Slave. I mean, every single one of the winners of the Birdman, every single one of the winners of the Spirits in recent years has gone on to win the Oscar. But this year they didn't have all the nominees in contention. They weren't the two top dogs, if you like, Three Billboards and Shape of Water were not nominated for Best Feature. They chose not to do that, the jury. And so he had it all to himself, basically. Get Out, Jordan Peele.
So with more awards that are becoming more predictive, the BAFTAs sort of mirror the Oscars in the way they're voted on, and you've got more Guild Awards, and people are savvier about what to pay attention to and what not to pay attention to. Is it getting harder and harder to be surprised at the top awards?
You know, that's a good point. This year, though, there was a race because some people were giving more credence to the BAFTAs. What happened was that Three Billboards, Get Out, and Shape of Water were all taking different awards. So they were, especially Three Billboards and Shape of Water. So people were saying, well, Shape of Water didn't get a SAG ensemble nomination. That usually means that it doesn't get to win Best Picture in just statistical terms. And I just wrote that off. I said, it's so obvious that the actors support Shape of Water. They gave it three nominations. It's irrelevant. You know, even if Billboards won the SAG. Also, there's an interesting thing that has happened in the last 3 years when they've added more members, a lot more members to a lot more branches. There are 17 branches of the Academy. The branch that's exactly the same size as it's always been is the acting branch, which is the single largest branch, and that's still true. But if you add up all the crafts and create a block of voters of similar taste, you know, who reward the technical and creative production side of the movies, they add up to like 3,200 people. So that's why I believed that The Shape of Water had a chance, having won the PGA, having won the DGA, that those guild nominations and other things too, you know, along the way, like production design, that they were, and score, you know, I knew they were going to win those four for whatever reason I knew, even though I was nervous.
What about The Shape of Water?
Well, I thought Shape of Water would win. I was nervous that Three Billboards would win. I would have been happy if Get Out had won, but I didn't think that it was likely. It didn't have an editing nomination. It only had four nominations. It would have been really precedent breaking for that to win.
You know, something about that, and I emailed you over the weekend and said, there's just something, you can kind of hear it in the wind, that just the way they do this, the Best Picture voting, where it's kind of this, I want to say regressive, but that's not the
right. The preferential ballot
where you number them 1 to 10. Somehow, like, Get Out would be number 2 or 3 on everybody's ballot, and might, if everything gets split between The Shape of Water and Three Billboards, in the end, Get Out or a Lady Bird might come rocketing forward. But I wonder if between Get Out and Lady Bird, you know, like half the people put
they have exactly the same constituents.
Yes.
And so does Get, they really do. And actually Billboards does too. I mean, those three movies all had support from writers and actors.
My thought for the spoiler was Dunkirk, because I felt like there were people who loved Get Out, but there were other people who really didn't like it. They were divisive. It was a horror film, or Lady Bird was just not that important, or Three Billboards had some problematic issues, and they also had the same core audience, like you say, the sort of indie people. And I felt like the surprise vote might be Dunkirk, because it was clearly respected by virtually everybody. And it also had sort of a hip young edge to it. And I thought maybe that'll be the one that'll shock us. But like you, I figured Shape of Water would win it all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that Get Out was playing, and Lady Bird especially, were playing really well with the younger demo and playing really well in New York. And there were a lot of people who really wanted to see that happen. But I thought he would win, Jordan Peele would win original screenplay, and he did. And I was afraid that Lady Bird wouldn't win anything, and it didn't. Laurie Metcalfe was a sort of outside chance. But, you know, Allison Janney just won everyone over. She was so popular on the campaign trail, you know, and people just adored her. And Laurie Metcalfe is a great, great actress, but she's not as winning in person.
And is that why Guillermo del Toro was such a favorite? People said, on the one hand, Call Me By Your Name exhausted everyone because it sort of was campaigning for 11 months, whereas del Toro in the fall, everybody just fell in love with him all over again. They just were crazy about him, and he was so winning in the Q&As and this and that, that they just loved him, and you know, they already liked the movie, so he just won everybody over.
I believe that's true, and I believe that's been true for a long time, though. I think Guillermo is a fixture, you know, someone that people really care about, and he's a beloved figure. I mean, how could you not like him, you know? And he gave a lovely speech last night, and it was very moving to me, and I was rooting for him myself. I really wanted him to. No one was doubting that he would win Best Director. That was in the bag. But, you know, probably production design and score. But for him to win Best Picture was a huge deal.
Well, you know, I'm waiting for, if I was a writer of, say, the Daily Show or one of these late night shows, I would have to write a joke about how, you know, Guillermo del Toro comes from Mexico and now we must be shipping the directing jobs overseas, too.
Oh, God.
But I thought he did a very good job of, you know, in a very political moment, yes, speaking from his heart and actually saying something of value.
Well, here's a question I have for you guys. I mean, one thing that I was struck by, and I have to watch the show again because I, you know, you miss things in the heat of the moment. But I really wondered if all the politics of with the women presenters and Frances McDormand and having people stand up. I loved her, of course. I was in it. I am supporting inclusion writers and whatever else can go forward to help make the movies a more equal playing field for everyone, you know, women and minorities and everyone. We just have to. And seeing something like Black Panther do as well as it's doing only reinforces. And Shape of Water, by the way, will be the highest grossing of all the
Best
the winners.
Yeah.
Well, Dunkirk, not Dunkirk.
Dunkirk is the biggest, of course.
And Get Out
on the indie. Dunkirk and Get Out, but of the specialty movies. You know, the indie movies, not the commercial movies.
Well, Frances McDormand won. She certainly won Best Actress. That's, you know, we all watched that, but she probably won the night by her speech. And she asked all of the women nominees in the audience to stand up. And it was this big moment, so big that it kind of stepped on her saying goodbye, except she left us with those two words that you just mentioned, inclusion rider. And I wonder if anybody outside the industry knew what the heck she was talking about.
I didn't know. I mean, I sort of looked at the people around me in the press room and I went, inclusion writer? And so of course we looked it up, and when she came backstage we asked her about it and she explained it. And basically it's something you can put in a contract. It's something that you can ask for. Someone like her, a star, can say, I won't do your movie unless you put this inclusion rider in, which says that 50% of the people in the movie have to be women and so forth. So it's really a legal thing.
Right.
And lawyers know about it, and it's an optional thing.
How did it play in the room? Because you were there. Were you backstage?
I was backstage. What I was wondering, if you think about the Oscars, you know how people say that the indies have taken over the Oscars? I was really aware that the politics of Hollywood were very front and center. And of course, the politics of Hollywood are very liberal and it's all overdue and it's got to happen. But I wondered how that played in the mainstream of America.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Although, let's face it.
Because the movies are supposed to be inclusive of everyone, and they're not. But they're also supposed to be inclusive of Republicans and, you know, conservatives and Trump supporters. It's not, we're not supposed to be leaving them out of the Oscar ceremony, if you see what I mean.
Well, we're not supposed to have Oscar ceremony celebrating racists and KKKers, but you know, conservatives,
the movies are supposed to be appealing and popular for everyone. And while I want Hollywood to do all of these things, but they were putting this agenda, this political agenda, way out front at an Oscar ceremony. I'm not saying they did the wrong thing. I'm just questioning what its impact is going to be on mainstream America. Do you follow my drift?
Absolutely. I think that's why they had the military montage. They celebrated war films to show we thank our troops. And it may also be the reason why it's the lowest rated Oscars of all time. 28 to 29 million viewers is the current prediction of how many people they will have reached. But to put that into context, the Winter Olympics was also the lowest rated of all time. It's just a different world now. You're not going to get 40 million people most times. And, you know, it's still a ton of people compared to the rest of the TV landscape.
Yeah. But it's also a question of keeping the Oscars relevant going forward, keeping the movies, which are in some ways being challenged by places like Netflix. You know, the two-hour movie is not necessarily a surviving entity in theaters, you know? I'm worried about it. We have to do well. We have to keep everybody coming.
Well, and they tried to actually highlight that last night by walking into a movie theater and handing out candy. I mean, those little stunts are, they kind of, in a very long show, are maybe unnecessary. But they were trying to thank moviegoers themselves. I don't know how well that played.
Actually, I thought the gag that played really well was the, you know, who's going to win the shortest acceptance speech
that
gag.
That worked.
With the car, with the jet ski and Helen Mirren draped over the. I thought she was hilarious the whole night. I loved it.
And it was referenced a couple times too. You know, Gary Oldman said, "Oh, I guess I'm not winning that."
She and Jane Fonda were very funny, I thought, when they came out. I got a kick out of a lot of that stuff. But did it play long to you guys? Did it play boring? I mean, it was a little on the dull side in the sense that a lot of the expected winners did win. That's true.
Well, I can tell you that this was the first year that I watched it with my oldest daughter, who was about to turn 13. And she was into it in the beginning. And then she realized, I don't know any of these movies. And then she got bored of trying to pick winners of movies she had never seen, except for Coco. And then, you know, she got, by hour three, she was like, is this almost over?
Yeah. No, I actually am teaching a class at USC, and I was talking to the kids, and I realized that they really weren't into it, except it's exactly like my 28-year-old daughter. They know Get Out. They know Lady Bird. They know the movies, you know, Black Panther. They know the movies that play for a younger audience.
Well, I can tell you one thing, that my daughters were devastated that the song from The Greatest Showman, a movie they have not seen, by the way, did not win Best Song. Remember Me did. But they did ask, after the performance of Remember Me, was that first guy supposed to be bad?
That's a subject I brought up with my daughter. I thought that I'm a big fan of Gael Garcia Bernal, who's a wonderful in Coco as the what's the name of his character, the musician who can't get back from the Day of the Dead.
Hector Rivera.
He plays Hector, right? And he. My daughter thought he was supposed to be like that, and she found him authentic. I heard it, and I thought it sounded bad, like someone who couldn't sing, who didn't practice.
I think we knew he couldn't sing that well, but I don't think we expected Miguel to sound flat and off-key as well. So that was a pretty ramshackle performance. I thought Sufjan Stevens did the best job with the songs.
He was great.
I thought, actually, I can't remember the name of the song.
Mary J. Blige was good, too. Mighty River.
Stand Up.
Stand Up is the
common.
Yeah. What is the song from The Greatest Showman? This Is Me?
Yeah.
This Is Me.
And I mean, I thought that that had everybody on their feet in the audience. It's a fun song, and my kids know every word of it. And the album is, the soundtrack is a number one hit. I thought for sure that was going to win, but I guess in hindsight, I should have predicted that it would be Remember Me.
Well, Remember Me is so integral to the movie, to Coco. You know, and it's such an important anthem in the movie. And I think it had a head start. I think it was around longer. Everybody knew about it. Whereas This Is Me, The Greatest Showman, wasn't such a good movie, even though it's a surprise hit. My daughter was rooting for that, too. She loves that movie. She thinks it's great.
Well, the best song winner actually was my high and low point of the night all at once. The couple won, and then their daughter in the audience positioned herself to be on camera and then turned to face the camera. She's very camera aware. The two little girls, they had a seat between them, and she moved over so they could be together, and then she turned to where the camera was. I thought that was hilarious. And then they started to play him off, Mr. Lopez, off until he started mentioning his late mother, and then they immediately cut the music off to not be tacky. But then he made that really unnecessary reference to Frozen opening on Broadway as if it needed a plug. And I thought that was just really crass, given all their success. It's like, you don't need to plug Frozen on Broadway. So that was the best and the worst all in one little song.
That guy, he's the only living EGOT winner.
Double EGOT.
I love that, yeah.
Double EGOT?
It's great. He's won, yeah, he's won two, and for different projects. He won his Daytime Emmy for The Wonder Pets, a show that he's done songs for. He won Tony's for Book of Mormon and Avenue Q, and he's won Oscars for Coco and the Disney movie Frozen. So three different, you know, lots of different projects. It's not like he had one project.
And there must be some Grammys in there as well.
Right, the Grammys were for both the Tony shows and stuff, so there's some overlap there. But yeah, it's not like he won them all for one project. Like sometimes Lurita Moreno, she won the Oscars, she won the Tonys, she won the, you know. But no, and the Grammy all for one project. This is for lots of different projects, so that's really impressive. He's also the youngest person who ever won the EGOT, and of course now the youngest one to win a double EGOT. So he's amazing. Got the triple EGOT in his sights.
You know, I everybody made jokes twice, in fact, about Christopher Plummer's age last night being the oldest nominated person. Is it ever or just last night?
89 of all time.
Of all time.
No, he's younger. He's 86. The other guy is 89. James Ivory, is all time. And if Agnes Varda had won, she would have been the oldest. A week older than him. Okay. But she didn't. So he's the oldest Oscar winner of all time.
Well, you broke up there for a minute, but you're saying that Agnes Varda would have been the oldest if she had won, and she was nominated for a documentary, Faces Places, which you had picked to win the documentary.
I was upset. I was upset about that. And I realized in hindsight that I love that movie. Sometimes loving movies gets in your way. You know, like I was cynical enough to recognize that they were going to vote for Kobe Bryant for Dear Basketball, no matter what that short looked like or sounded like. And it was amusing to me that Kobe Bryant would go backstage and have everybody jump up and down and yell and scream and whoop and holler and not realize that he won because he's Kobe Bryant.
Right.
Not because he did a good job writing this animated movie, which is basically a commercial for him.
That's right. You know? Yeah. Well, the film that did win Best Documentary was Icarus, which, given the subject matter and how important that story is, it was about the doping scheme in Russia.
Well, it's sports,
but they're all
again.
Important.
So basically, you have this situation where the Olympics promoted this movie, and I recognized that this was happening, and I wrote a story about it. I was right, but I wasn't right enough to see that it would steal it away from Agnes Varda. But it's a huge story. It's about the Olympic doping scandal and Russia. And I loved Jimmy Kimmel's quip. You know, I guess Putin didn't rig that election.
That was
because the Russians hate this guy, Dr. Grigory Rodchenko, who revealed all of this, and it has all been verified. And yet, this guy Thomas Bach, B-A-C-H, that this guy who's the head of the International Olympic Committee should be taken off the job. He should be fired because they let all these Russian athletes compete anyway, and two of them were caught doping, and, you know, they didn't punish Russia sufficiently.
I mean, that's a whole other topic, but I agree with that statement. If, like, so you basically let them back in, you're like, okay.
Yeah. It made that was a big brouhaha backstage as well. And so if there's a, you know, there's two ways to go. I mean, there's another category where the movie that was more artful and more elegant, you know, beat out the movie that was more timely and newsworthy. For example, I thought Heroin would win documentary short, but it went to Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405, which is a beautifully, artfully done movie. And then The Silent Child won over the one that I more cynically thought would win, which was DeKalb Elementary in the short category, because I thought the school shooting would push that one. But they went with the artful one in that case.
But to put it in context, you had a good night. You got 20 out of 24. I only got 19 out of 24, right? So you only missed four, and two of them were the shorts, which are historically by far the hardest ones to pick.
I always mess up the shorts because it's, if I pick the one I really like the best, I lose. If I'm cynical about it with Dear Basketball, I won that one. But, you know, if I go with what everybody tells me, I lose. I have not figured it out yet how to win the shorts.
For me, I thought they figured out how to deal with the speeches. They just said, hey, please keep it short. And then they didn't, by and large, play people off, which I thought was absolutely the right way to go. Unless there's seven people up there, don't play them off. Let them speak. They know to be quick. And I thought it worked really well this year.
I think they felt the urgency of trying to be efficient. You could tell.
Yeah. And yet the show was 3.5 hours long. Go figure. Let me ask you this. Every year you're either backstage or in the audience at the Oscars, but you're also on the red carpet. Were you on the red carpet this year?
This is the first year I didn't do it, and I didn't miss it, honestly. I like walking it as a guest. That I like. I love it, in fact. It's one of the most fun things in the whole world. But something about the way that they have placed the press corps that gets to be on the red carpet, where I was at the very end of it, you know, it just, they don't come over. They've turned it into a photo op. So there's a place where they all get their picture taken, but you have to sort of wave at them and get them to come over to you, and they never do anymore. So I don't like it.
You know who they weren't, you know, they don't come over to Ryan Seacrest anymore either, apparently.
Well, what was, but there's some like revisionary story today that Taraji P. Henson actually was trying to tell him to keep his chin up.
Well, Ryan Seacrest, for those of you who don't, you know, our international listeners who may not actually know him, it would be hard to imagine since he has literally 12 jobs. He's a radio DJ. He's on a talk show host. He's on American Idol, the host of American Idol. And he does this, the red carpet thing for the Oscars with E. There are some allegations, sexual misconduct allegations. And I guess, you know, look, if any of this...
There was an investigation and he was cleared. However, then the woman came forward with her story and brought up another eyewitness to one or two of the incidents. And so it has been kept alive. But we did just get the final numbers, or at least the latest final numbers. Oscars hit a new viewership low of 26.5 million viewers. Short of just insisting that the comic book and Star Wars movies get a nomination for Best Picture, I don't think there's any way to fix that. Just try to make the most entertaining show you can.
And I think they need to go back to five. I just hate this preferential ballot. I interviewed a bunch of Oscar voters this year for these anonymous ballot stories that we did, which were sort of fun. I enjoyed that. And they all said they didn't understand it. People kept telling them to game it, to take their number one choice and move it down on the ballot. You know, that kind of thing is terrible. They should be honest. They should only put what they like best, and it should be the one with the most votes that wins. And I don't understand why they keep hanging on to this if it isn't even helping their ratings.
You know my thoughts on this. I detest the preferential ballot. I just do not like it.
But I don't think that's linked to having 10 best films. Those are different issues, aren't they?
The way that it works is if there are enough passionate number one votes, that determines whether you have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10. It can be anywhere from 5 to 10, depending. And this year there were 9.
And there's almost always been 9. So I think, why not just make it 10? Whatever, however you do
it. Sometimes it's 8. Sometimes it's 8. They changed it from 10 because they didn't want to have to feel like there was some movies on there that weren't, you know, consensus passionate votes. Whatever. I think they keep twisting themselves into pretzels to do this. And I think it's time to go back to 5. I really do.
Well, okay. So that was last year's Oscars. Here's the question about next year's Oscars. I guess the only thing we can ask at this point is about Black Panther and will
Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, exactly. That's where I was headed. The host, is it going to be Maya Rudolph and Tiffany Haddish?
They were great. They were so awesome. It's pretty clear that it's time to not necessarily have a white male. They would be great. And Black Panther, totally. It will be in the conversation. There's no question in my mind already for a lot of crafts, if nothing else.
Yes.
Maybe crafts, but it won't be nominated for Best Picture.
It might be. It has a different level of gravitas and seriousness than Wonder Woman. And I knew that Wonder Woman wasn't going to get nominated for a lot of the crafts. I don't know why I knew that, but I knew it, and it wasn't. So this one has a very top level costume designer, Ruth Carter, who's been nominated twice. It has superb production design, and it has a great performance by Michael B. Jordan in a supporting actor performance. I mean, it kind of steals the movie from Chadwick Boseman.
I'd say it's so. Yeah, that's true.
And maybe, you know, maybe we can get one of those women, one of those great women in there. It is just a higher level of production all the way around. And I think it might get in there.
Well, I predict you'll, like all the fans of the comic book movies, you'll be very disappointed next year. I predict it won't get any acting nominations and certainly not Best Picture. So we'll have to see.
And I'm still trying to figure out how Dunkirk won Best Editing because I still have no idea what was going on in that movie.
I love Dunkirk, and I think it's a superb accomplishment, but obviously he didn't have enough support from the actors and the writers and the people who think that a movie like this should have more character work for the, you know, if people want to involve themselves in characters, and this was a radical movie in its way. I thought it was brilliant, but in a weird way, it made the film more cold. It wasn't as emotional for people.
Yes, and of course, I'm making light of the fact that I didn't know what was going on in the movie. Obviously, it was a deconstructed narrative, which was indeed rather interesting. It did, as you say, make it a little almost textbook or...
I wept.
There's something
I
clinical
wept.
About
I
it.
Yes, thank you. That's
I knew
the
they were. You had the coward, little adorable Harry Styles, sort of, you know, a little bit of a little turned on the other guy. You had the nice French guy who just wanted to live. You had our hero who just wanted to live. You had Kenneth Branagh and Mark Rylance breaking our heart. I knew everybody was. It was a wonderful film. I wept like a baby. I saw it for a third time just a week ago.
I'm with you, especially if you see it big.
Oh, yeah.
What they did with the cameras, I'm glad that Roger Deakins won finally. Thank you very much.
Thank goodness.
And I did mess up. I knew the other movie I was torturing myself about at the end was VFX.
Yep.
I had a feeling it was going to go to Blade Runner. And I just wanted, again, I wanted those people from War from the Planet of the Apes to win. I just did.
Yeah, so, I think they almost take for granted what they do.
I know.
On
they
those
think
movies.
It looks too easy.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And I think that Roger Deakins winning, he got up on stage, he's the cinematographer, he's been nominated 14 times, he finally won. I think he didn't have anything. He was like, I didn't expect to win. I got nothing.
I think he's not a speaker, that's all. Like Rachel Morrison said, she dreaded the idea of being up on stage. He's just not, he likes to be behind the camera, not in front of it.
Yeah, good point.
I agree with that.
Well, we have no cameras because we only have microphones. And certainly, thank you, Anne, once again for joining us after the Oscars. I mean, you must be exhausted, and you're going to take the week off, and then, you know, the season has already begun, so you'll just take a vacation and then catch up.
I'm heading into Emmys, my dear.
Oh, I was joking around, and yet you're not.
I'm going to go away. I'm going to go to the Miami Film Festival for a few days and have some fun, and then I'll come back and get serious again.
Okay, well, in the meantime, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to all of us about this year's Oscar ceremony.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So Anne has gone to the after party. Did you watch Alec Baldwin's show?
Alec Baldwin's show? No. What are you talking about?
After the Oscars, they previewed his talk show. He interviewed Jerry Seinfeld and Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live.
Oh, no, I did not do that. No. You know, first of all, I DVR'd the whole Oscars and yeah, no, I did not do that.
Oh, it was after the local news. I think the idea is a late night show on Sunday nights. So it's sort of like the Bob Costas show that he had. It's just him one-on-one with somebody for half an hour. And it was, perfectly amiable. But I guess it's sort of just a late night on the Sunday sort of thing. But yeah, it was after the Oscars. But given it was, after the local news and the darn thing was 3.5 hours long, I wonder how many people saw it.
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly nobody on the East Coast. Now, didn't Alec Baldwin write a book?
Sure.
Like recently, like as Trump or about Trump or something about that? No? Am I wrong?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He did. Okay, well, I couldn't remember because it was not one of your picks of the week. And by that, I mean, we're moving on to our book filter section. And every week, Michael, you dive into the new releases, the new book releases, and you bring us a book that's ready for its close-up. And maybe it's good for television, maybe it's good for movies. What have you got for us this week, Michael?
Well, this week I have a history book, a popular history book called The Woman's Hour by Elaine Weiss. She's a contributor to the New York Times, The Atlantic, and others. She had a McDowell grant to be at the colony there. I imagine she was working on this book there. It's a colorful, popular history about the fight for suffragettes, the fight to get women the vote in the United States. There's been other books about that. There was just an HBO miniseries. What I like about this book is it focuses in on the final battle in Tennessee. 35 states had ratified women's right to vote in every election. The country was sort of a patchwork quilt where some states women could vote for like mayor and president of the U.S., but not any state or local positions like governor. And other states, they couldn't vote at all. It was just different state to state, and women have been fighting. And around the world, while women have been fighting for 80 years to get the vote, 20 other countries had given women the vote in every election. The U.S. obviously had not. It began sort of out of the abolition movement. Women were really active fighting to end slavery, and they started to pay attention. Go, gee, all the arguments that we give about the South gave about why slaves shouldn't have citizenship or the right to vote, it's kind of the same thing what you say about us. And women got harassed and jailed and threatened and ridiculed and mocked just for trying to speak in public. That alone was seen as an outrage. For a woman to stand up and give a speech was an outrage during the anti-slavery movement. So all those women became energized. They became politicized. They saw they could have power and get things done. And they got experience in running nationwide campaigns. And they turned it and said, hey, let's use that to get ourselves the right to vote. And so it all came down to Tennessee. 35 states had ratified the amendment. The rest had either rejected it or wouldn't even bother. And those were basically the slave states, the former Confederacy. And that left Tennessee, which was a southern state. It was a slave state. And that's where everyone converged on this final battle. If they didn't get it passed in Tennessee, it was going to have to start all over from scratch and could take years or a decade or decades for women to get the vote. It sounds silly now to think about it, like how long could it take? But it could have delayed it for many, many years. So we have three major women converging on this state. One is the head of the more traditional women's suffrage movement organization. It's the classic one. They were polite. They were friendly. They were firm and kind, but they behaved themselves. Another one was a radical spinoff, and they were the women who would, handcuff themselves to the gate of the White House. They would protest. They were just seen as outrageous and, insane. They're sort of the ACT UP of their day. And the third person was a woman who fought against women getting the right to vote, a Southerner who thought it was an outrage and would destroy the nation and the morals of our country. So you had the radical, you had the traditional fighter, and you had the woman who didn't want women to get the right to vote. And they all descended on Tennessee and had a battle royal where they tried to fight it out and see if women could get the vote or whether it would take years or decades to come. So it's a really fun story.
So it's like
really entertaining.
It's like Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN.
Yeah, that's a good comparison, actually. Actually, it's a nice, good comparison. So, yeah, they're very colorful characters. The governor, this, that, all the ins and outs. It's very exciting. It's very fun. You have that ticking clock sense of like Tennessee is the last state. You know, the movie or TV miniseries would begin. 35 states have ratified it. 11 have rejected it or won't even bother. It's all down to Tennessee. And they have to make it happen.
Would it be scrolling up in a yellow typeface against a black star?
I think it would. So it's a fun story. Actually, a lot of great characters, a lot of fascinating ins and outs, dramatic stuff going on. It's cool. I think it would make a great project.
Well, from sexual harassment, as you just mentioned, they were being harassed sexually. Well, to actual sexually harassment from 4 hour sexual misconduct palooza segment. And no, we're not making light of it, but we needed to name it something. And
it's okay.
I don't know who named it, but in any case, I think you said you named it. But in any case, this week we actually have what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, last week we teased a little item which we forgot to cover. We got so excited about this, that, and the other thing. It's a report on the top 100 grossing movies of the year. And in 2017, just 24% of the protagonists were women. That was a drop of 5 percentage points from the year earlier, where 29% of the protagonists were women. Even though three of the most popular films of the year, Star Wars, The Last Jedi, Beauty and the Beast, and Wonder Woman, all had major female lead characters. So, you know, it's a step back. So when you want to think about how much work there is to do, the fact that women are not directing movies, they're not writing movies, they're not starring in movies and anywhere near the number that they exist and actually go to the movies, since they're your number one audience, kind of crazy.
Well, and do we want to talk about Sherman Alexie or not?
Well, yeah, you know, there's a lot of fallout in the young adult area, and it's complicated. Sherman Alexie is a hugely important author. He's a Native American and a beloved figure in the young adult world for the books that he's written that have been really powerful and important. But he now has issues that women are complaining and raising about him. He's addressed some of them. One is an ex-girlfriend. It's complicated. It's ugly. People don't know what to do. This is a guy who's a trailblazer in some categories, and now they're finding out that maybe they're less comfortable supporting him in the future because of other areas where he has maybe fallen short. So that's all trying to shake itself out. It's difficult. It's kind of like what the Hollywood stars had to deal with Ryan Seacrest. Do I talk to him? Do I not talk to him? Am I endorsing him? You know, they don't know what to say or do. But we do know that the Weinstein sale is back on. Shows what I know. We thought the Weinstein sale was dead in the water and they'd have to just break it up for parts. But no, it's back on. It looks like it's going to be approved. Bob Weinstein gets the Dimension brand and one movie, Polaroid. And the new owners get 277 films, including the Dimension titles. And that may be the most valuable part of the entire thing, isn't it?
Well, that's true. The library is always the valuable asset here, rather than, say, the films that you have in development, because those aren't made yet. And you're basically buying potential. But at the end of the day, for Bob Weinstein to get the Dimension brand, look, he was always in charge of Dimension. That was always his baby. And but those films were often very successful. So they're basically saying you can have the Dimension brand, but we're taking all the films with us. We're taking the thing that's really valuable. They're in a way they're setting him up to fail, I think. But
well, I don't think so. He always made commercial films and that division was profitable. And for some years or quite a few years, that was the one paying the rent. Well, Harvey got all the glory of accolades and awards, whereas Bob was making films that actually made a lot of money. So, he's still got that talent. The Dimension brand is not damaged by the name of Weinstein. And if people are willing to work with Bob and don't see him as sullied, one presumes he still has the good taste to make, horror flicks and films like that and make money. So if he can get backers and people are willing to work with him, he's got the same talent he had as before, so I don't see why he would be set up to fail. He just doesn't have the cushion of a library and the big infrastructure that the Weinstein Company had.
Well, and David Glasser, who was the head of the company just last week or 2 weeks ago and was forced out by the Attorney General of New York, suing the company for literally, in one case, actually having David Glasser as the head of the company. The Attorney General said, look, David Glasser is part of the problem. The new owner, Ron Burkle, and it's an investment group headed by Ron Burkle, they want him on the board.
They still are thinking of having him on the board. God knows why. But the board, they say, will be female dominated. And a deal seems to be made. It's not signed and dotted. But, we thought it was dead. I don't know. I'm not quite sure who wants to make their movie and have it released by the Weinstein Company. But, you know, I don't know. More power to them, I guess. You know, if you clear house and you've got talented people who want to make movies, it's always good to have more people making films in Hollywood. I guess it's a, you know, I don't know. It's, I don't think it's a big deal until we see what sort of money they have and what, how they're going to go forward from all this mess.
Well, if that story isn't a big deal, I don't know what is. Actually, you know what? Maybe some of the stories in our Big Deal Big Whoop segment are. It is indeed time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Spotify is going public. They officially filed papers for a public offering. It's a special public offering, and it's a special public offering in a way that lets them pitch the stock directly to buyers without hiring a bank or financial institution to oversee the sale. This saves them money up front, but it also raises eyebrows since Spotify continues to lose money, faces a string of lawsuits, and maybe savvy buyers wouldn't be so excited about what they're offering. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. Now we get to say Spot rather than Spotify, since that's going to be their tag name under the New York Stock Exchange. They're going to be doing a direct listing, so we'll have to see how that works out. It's the biggest direct listing of all time. They're saying maybe they could be worth as much as $20, $23 billion. We do know they generated $5 billion last year, and they lost $460 million last year, which is more than they lost in 2016. So they're grossing more money and losing more money at the same time. Sounds like the same business plan as MoviePass.
What, to lose money up front and then
lose a lot of money and yet somehow get people to invest in you? Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. We should have done that. We should be charging like $1,000 a subscription or something. I don't know. We should be doing something to lose a lot of money so we can pay ourselves a lot. I think we missed the boat on that one.
Well, but, just to give you some sense,
we don't.
Just to give you some sense. Okay, so they're trying to raise $1 billion, right, through this offering. When Facebook,
is that it? They're trying to cap it at a billion?
Well, I think that's what they're trying to raise, okay? That doesn't necessarily mean that's how much their company is worth, okay?
No, they're saying the company's worth $20 billion, okay. not a billion. Yeah.
Right, and so that means they can, you know, put more shares out there later. Right now, they're looking for $1 billion. When Facebook went public, they raised $16.08 billion.
Mm-hmm. Well, a few things that they sort of leaked out in their, what they're claiming in their filing is that they have twice as many paying subscribers as Apple Music, including me, that their users stream 25 hours of audio every month on average. You know, 31% of them listen to playlists, 31% of the listening happens via playlists. I know that Randy Travis, the country music star who can't really sing and perform anymore, he just announced a big new playlist that he's got. Premium subscribers listen to three times as much music on average as regular people who listen to ad-supported Spotify. And their revenue from, you know, premium subscribers, it's been declining. It's gone down a little bit, maybe because they're getting more family accounts and things like that, student accounts that they're trying to compete with what Apple was offering. So, you know, it's interesting. Get a little more details. Get to look under the hood. I personally would not invest in it.
Well, the case is far from over, but Fox News just won a big victory in the courts. They served a company called TV Eyes that makes clips available to everyone from politicians to the Red Cross to the media. The company cross-indexes clips from cable channels like Fox News, allowing users to search for, say, gun control and get tons of pertinent clips. An early ruling agreed that indexing Fox News into clips by search items was transformative, but thought that they went too far in letting users search, download, and share clips. Well, now a ruling says, in fact, that there's no fair use in play at all. It's going to be appealed or moved directly to another venue, no doubt. But for the moment, Fox News wins big, and The Daily Show will find out that much harder, it's going to be much harder for them to pull up all these relevant clips because they're one of the big customers that TV Eyes has. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because it's an interim ruling. I think it's a really bad one. Clearly, when you are indexing and doing all this stuff and pulling out little quotes and clips from a show, it's transformative and fair use, and it's a useful service. And when you look who their audience is, it's not the public. You know, they're not cheating Fox News out of the public, you know, that watches Fox News just because all their content is on there sliced and diced in different ways. Fox News doesn't offer this service. So they're providing a service. To me, it's fair use. It's transformative. And given the audience, politicians, the media, whatever, it's a useful service. And it's clearly, I think, okay. But boy, it's a bad ruling for a lot of people because a lot of people do this.
Yeah. You know, look, whether you're John Oliver on This Week Tonight or or Last Week Tonight, or The Daily Show, or any number of these shows, even if you are a legitimate news outlet, that's who is using TV eyes to pull up that kind of footage.
Yeah, I mean, they've all got DVRs running all day, every day to watch stuff and fast forward and try to catch things. But also when you want clips from the past, like, oh, what has Jeff Sessions said about guns? What has Jeff Sessions said about gays? It's just an easier way to pull all those clips out.
Yeah, so, that's right.
To me, it's clearly a useful transformative service. I haven't read the ruling, so I'm not quite sure why they suddenly got to this bizarro ruling, but it's a big win for Fox.
Well, I'll tell you, if the ruling stands, you have to burn all the microfiche. Speaking of fair use, filmmakers have filed a petition with the Copyright Office. Their plea? Include us in the exemptions category so we can rip Blu-rays without breaking the law. They say that even people with a fair use right to clips are forced to technically break the law if they want to grab clips from a Blu-ray for any number of legitimate purposes. Also, they want exemptions for more than just limited use in documentaries and educational settings. The Motion Picture Association of America says, well, sorry, but you need to pay for the clips you use. If you don't like the licensing fees being charged by copyright holders, well, that's just too bad. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because the fight for fair use is ongoing. It's constant. They always want to tell you don't have the right to do this, you don't have the right to do that, when you can and should have the right. And I think this is another one. And they're limiting it to just the format. They're saying the MPA does not want even the documentary exemption extended to 4K and the newer format. And they say, oh, no, that's totally different. And they don't need that anyway. It's not important. It's like, well, why would it matter if it was on a Blu-ray or a DVD or a Laserdisc or a digital download or a 4K or whatever the format? If they have the right to pull clips for documentary purposes, they should be able to have the right to pull it from a 4K. You know, that's just bizarre to me. So my instinct, I like filmmakers, you want to support their right, but my instinct is that people pulling clips for fair use should not have to technically break the law just to rip it from a DVD or Blu-ray. It's silly. And the argument that they need to pay for clips, probably not true. If they're using it in a way they need to pay for the clips, then they have to pay for the clips. If they do it unfairly, they will get sued and lose a lot of money. So, you know.
Americans love PBS. The Brits, they're proud of their BBC. And yet, somebody somewhere is always pushing to cut off funds for public service broadcasting. The latest battleground? Switzerland, of all places. A group got 100,000 people to support a petition, and that led to a public vote on whether or not the license fee for public TV and radio in Switzerland should continue. So I guess the group was trying to say, we don't want to pay for this anymore.
Exactly.
Happily, it wasn't even close, with more than 70% of the votes supporting the license fee. Some things, I guess, are worth paying for, apparently, like Showbiz Sandbox. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, there's only like 8 million people in the entire country. So to get 100,000 people to sign a petition meant you thought, oh my gosh, there must be a lot of support for this. But turned out there wasn't. So that's really cool. I think public broadcasting and these things are hugely important. They're resources for every country. Every country should have it. It's cool that they endorsed it again so strongly. So it's great to see. And I hope we learn that lesson here in the U.S.
Well, that was fast. Former governor and presidential hopeful Mike Huckabee joined the Country Music Association's charitable foundation devoted to getting music training into schools. And in less than 24 hours, he was forced to resign. The reason? Gays and guns. I just like saying that. Gays and guns. One of the biggest names in town is manager Jake Owens. He represents acts like Little Big Town and Casey Musgraves. With their support, he penned a letter to the CMA saying he and his acts would refuse to work with the foundation and indeed with anything to do with the CMA at all if it was going to magnify a voice of hate like Mike Huckabee. Owens pointed out that he's gay and has two kids, and Huckabee would deny his family basic civil rights. Oh, and Huckabee is an ardent supporter of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, a now touchy subject in Nashville ever since the slaughter of country music fans at a festival in Las Vegas. Owens was clearly the tip of the iceberg overseeing Huckabee as divisive, and the radio host quickly resigned, complaining on social media that hate wins. Others would say the opposite. In this case, actually hate lost because, well, you know, do the math. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. That's a sea change in country music to have Mike Huckabee be an untouchable. That's kind of amazing. And I don't think it was just Jake Owens. I think a lot of other people weighed in. country music. They went from being pretty right wing conservative to, you know, to pulling back in recent years. Like, first the Dixie Chicks were progressive and they got steamrolled and everybody just said, oh my God, they didn't want to talk about politics in the least. Now with Trump, they don't want to say anything about anything. There's very few people speaking left or right in Nashville. So to see this happens makes it feel like maybe there's a big sea change in that community happening. And they're very influential in the heartland. So it's interesting to see.
Well, here's that story we talked about at the head of the show. Broadway just got a little less bitchy. Longtime New York Post columnist Michael Rydell has been an old school fixture on the scene for years now, picking feuds, digging up dirt, being catty about shows that aren't doing well. And so kind of like what Michael does on, you know, Tuesday, you know, think Hedda Hopper more than, say, Liz Smith. But now he's gone. Rydell is quitting the New York Post to work full time in radio. He's joined 710 WOR, that's AM radio, by the way, to be the co-host of a morning chat show with Len Berman, of all people, a gig he's done on an ad hoc basis for years. Now he'll go full-time, and instead of just talking Broadway, Rydell will cover politics and sports and TV and movies and pretty much everything. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, talk about the fading of newspapers. He wasn't fired. He didn't lose his job. He quit. He kind of left and said, I'm out of here, to do this new interesting thing. I mean, good for him. He'd been doing theater for decades. He's written books on theater that were very well received. He's working on another book. He says he may continue to do his column on an ad hoc basis for the New York Post, though I don't know how well that would work out. But I mean, he is a real fixture on Broadway. And for him to say, yeah, I'm out of here, I think that really reflects poorly on the tabloid industry. You know, they fired so many people in the last few years that I just feel like maybe jump before you're pushed, or, you know, just that's not where the heat is. He wants to be on radio. I think it's a fascinating move. It's just it's a real sea change for Broadway. He brought a lot of attention to the industry, and they're not going to replace him. So there's no job for me to apply for. So, you know, it's a loss for the theater world. I'm not a big fan of his, but it is a loss for the theater world because he brings a lot of attention to Broadway, and his column gets quoted in a lot of other places. So it's bad for the theater world.
Is Netflix just another cable channel? Maybe, if you think HBO is just another cable channel and ESPN just another cable channel rather than a source of entertainment people consider must-haves for their home. Certainly the European satellite company Sky believes Netflix is must-see TV. They're bundling the streaming service into their package of offerings, assuming Netflix gets the same monthly fee. They're just extending their reach while Sky gets to boast they've got Stranger Things. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop in a way. It's just sort of like, okay, you can just get it on your cable package just like HBO. It makes it easier, I think, for people to get Netflix. People maybe who are a little more tech not savvy, like maybe older customers who can, maybe, oh, that's sort of interesting, but they don't want to have to deal with streaming and setting it up when they can just go, oh, it's in my cable package. It's easier for them to say yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's one more, you know, product that Sky is selling, and it's one more way for Netflix to gain a customer that can then be transferred either to a direct customer or, you know, they can, it's customer acquisition for Netflix.
Well, I assume it's the same price. I assume they're not taking the person for less. They're not going to give a discounted rate to someone who's on Sky.
Well, they might for the first year. And then, yeah. You know, yeah. Now, are you sick of ads on TV?
No, not really. I mean, I DVR everything and skip them entirely, so I don't even watch ads.
Well, are you sick of having so many ads then that you have to fast forward through?
Oh, actually, I am.
Okay, well then this, Michael, is your lucky day. NBC Universal announced it will be reducing ads by, get this, 20% across all of its networks. 20% fewer ads in prime time and daytime and on its cable channels. No word on whether they'll charge more for the ads that remain. And if ads upset you, why not try Pepto-Bismol? It coats, it soothes, and it relieves. The next time a glut of advertisements give you heartburn, don't grab the remote, grab a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. There are too many ads on TV. The clutter is amazing. I think it's a smart move to do. You've got valuable real estate. Make the most out of it. And when you've got 47 ads in an hour, that really doesn't help your advertisers. It's a smarter thing to have fewer, charge a little bit more, make everybody happier. But I didn't know we had a new sponsor. That's great.
Yeah, and they're not paying anything. But, you know, we're kind of used to that anyway. You know, when I have to do catch-up TV and I'm on the NBC website or some, you know, like Hulu, and I have to watch the ads, I actually have to watch the ads. They don't let you skip through them.
Oh, it's so frustrating.
But you know what? My feeling is, please switch the ads up. I don't mind if there's going to be an ad, but it's, like the same.
The same two ads. Yes. That's even worse. It's really eye plug. You're just like, oh, for the love of God.
Yes, for Pete's sake. Now, could InfoWars and Alex Jones be booted off of YouTube? And for those of you outside the U.S., this might be, do we want to explain what InfoWars is? It's kind of a conservative.
A far right conspiracy theory sort of nut job website that just peddles lies and misinformation.
Correct. The company announced, this is YouTube, it has given two strikes to Jones for violating its terms of conditions. In the past, that usually meant someone included a clip in their video that they didn't have the rights to share. But now they're giving Jones a strike for peddling lies, essentially conspiracy theories about the Parkland shooting that are utter nonsense and have no basis in fact or reality. Jones is crying foul. After all, his clips on YouTube are approaching 1 billion views, and the company's algorithm offering up his extremist content is a big reason why. Now his best platform for gaining attention and credibility and money may be cut off. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal and not all in a good way. I mean, it's good that they're saying on a case-by-case basis, well, this is just utter, you know, extremist lies, and why are we giving that a platform? And you can make that reasoned judgment. It doesn't mean you've done that for everything else on your 1 billion people posting videos every day. You can't do it for everyone, but when a big one comes to your attention, there's no reason why you can't make an one-off decision. The problem is, they're sort of trying to apply this to a bunch of different sites, and they're catching up sort of legitimate sites in this same net. So there are some, now that they're making this decision, they're not doing it in such a small pointed way. They're sort of grabbing up some small independent progressive sites and progressive things that are actually rooted in fact and reasonable, but they've decided, oh, that's maybe a conspiracy too. So they're not doing a great job. Alex Jones clearly would fall under anybody's example of like, this is total BS and dangerous and hateful, and we don't need to put it on our website. You know, you don't have to host Stormfront on your website if you don't want to. So he falls in that category, but there are others that they're pulling up with the same thing. They need to fix their algorithm so they don't keep, you know, encouraging this extremist content. They need to make these decisions on a case-by-case basis if they can, but they got to make sure they're not, you know, ending free speech or unpopular speech, because unpopular speech doesn't just mean right-wing nonsense. It also means conservative stuff or libertarian stuff that some people agree with, and maybe progressive stuff that's sort of on the fringe, but it's not peddling lies the way Alex Jones is. So you don't want to tamp down free speech along with trying to get rid of the really bad actors.
Yeah, you know, part of the issue here is that apparently the clips that were pulled down by a person, okay? It wasn't an algorithm. And they were posted back like 4 hours later. And so as YouTube kind of ramps up its, and you know, all of its overseers, they're hiring like 20,000 people this year to oversee all this content that's going up to make sure it isn't harmful or something that as you say might be false or untrue. And so it's the problem, of course, is this whole free speech debate. And what is free speech? Even if something is not true, is it free speech? It's going to get kind of sticky for them.
Well, they just need to do a better job. But this specifically is Alex Jones has gotten two strikes. If he gets a third strike, he's off of YouTube. They have the right to do that. They have no legal need. It's not a censoring of free speech for them to say, we don't want to host your stuff. They don't have to. You know, no company has to publish your book. No TV show has to carry your channel. No website has to host your videos. So YouTube can do that. They're not a public company. So it's not free speech in the sense of, oh, Alex Jones has been censored. Only the government can end his free speech rights. He's able to host and stream his stuff all he wants. He just won't have the glorified platform of YouTube to do it. However, they just need to do a good job and make sure they don't throw out stuff that's just unpopular with the stuff that's actually vile and unacceptable.
Disney is shutting down its online cloud service dubbed Disney Movies Anywhere. It was a way people could buy digital copies of movies and access them anywhere without having to download a copy onto each and every device. The problem? It was competing with Ultraviolet, a similar service that was supported by Paramount, Sony, and Lionsgate. Now all the big movie studios are supporting a new online locker service called Movies Anywhere. Not Disney Movies Anywhere, just Movies Anywhere. For some reason, the competitors with the Mouse House are fine with that name, I guess. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, you know, it doesn't say Disney in it, so, you know, it's a little easier to take. I guess it's a big whoop. I've never used this thing, have you?
I have not used Disney movies anywhere, but I guess I could have, because basically what it was is that you would buy the DVD or Blu-ray, and then if you wanted to watch it, you know, a movie that you had purchased, you could watch it on your laptop, on your...
You could stream it to your thing rather than having to download a copy.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, well, I guess there's still a demand for it.
Well, there may not be a lot of demand for Disney movies anywhere, or maybe even movies anywhere, but there is a lot of demand, apparently, for Sky Broadcasting. And that is what we will be discussing during Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
And I told you we should have made a bid for Sky. I told you that.
You did. A couple of weeks ago, you said, hey, how much do you have on you? And I said, well, a dollar or two. You said, well, that's not enough.
And what's happening? So Sky is the big European pay TV giant. It's a satellite service, right?
Right. And Fox loves them so much that they own what do they own? They own like something 39%, right? 39%. And they want to buy the remaining 61%. Okay.
But they also want to sell themselves.
Right. So it's this weird thing where they're like, we're buying you, and then we're immediately selling all of us to Disney. And the UK is saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Wait a second. You know, Rupert Murdoch, which owns Fox, you kind of had some issues lately, both with the whole wiretapping thing, the phone tapping thing, and you know, or phone hacking. It wasn't tapping. And now with the sexual misconduct issues, you know, maybe you're not fit and proper to be owning this much media in our country. So,
and more importantly, they would have too much concentration of media. They own newspapers, they own radio, they own, you know, television.
Right.
It would just be too much of a concentration of power in one hand.
Correct. And so they've got some, you know, I guess, bureaucratic issues to get over, if you will.
They had to be approved by the government. The government said, not so fast. We're not sure we're going to approve this. And now, suddenly, where that was sort of in peril, they're trying to buy it finally and then flip it over and sell themselves to Disney. Suddenly, a new buyer has popped up.
That's right. Comcast, you know, the much beloved cable provider here in the United States, and I say that with sarcasm intended, they have decided, hey, you know what? Michael and Sperling may only have a dollar or two between them, but apparently we have 22 billion pounds or $31 billion that we can throw into the pot and offer Sky. In fact, we're going to offer them a 16% premium on what 21st Century Fox is willing to pay for you. For not only just, I guess, your 61%, but for the entire company. And, well, that's kind of hard for Sky to turn down.
And would they get approved by European regulators? Right now, they have like 9% of their revenue comes from overseas. So this would be a great way for them to diversify. If they got Sky, then 25% of their revenues would come from international. So that would be a great way for them to, you know, smooth out their earnings. You know, it wouldn't be just the North American market. Of course, in 2011, they bought NBC Universal, and that means they also own movies, which go all over the world. In this case, they would be expanding to European television in a really big way.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder if this isn't, you know, Comcast tried to go out and buy 21st Century Fox, or at least the Fox, not 21st Century Fox, the Fox assets, the Fox Entertainment assets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Murdochs probably rightfully said, look, we can't do that because it's going to be really hard to get this past antitrust regulators. I get that. And I would agree with them on that, because you would then have Comcast, you'd basically have two broadcast networks, NBC and Fox, owned by the same company.
Which would be crazy.
Yeah, that would be unreal. As a matter of fact, that's what's going to happen when Disney purchases Fox. You're going to have ABC and
Fox
owned by the same company. And I don't know how they're going to get around that. They might have to, I don't know what they're going to do, come to think of it.
Well, and that's why this deal with Comcast may very well go through. They're paying a premium. And Disney just doesn't need the headache. They don't want to go into a bidding war to get Sky. They've got a big enough company as it is. And Fox doesn't care anymore because they're selling themselves to Disney. So Comcast can step in and say, hey, we'll pay a premium. We'll get this. There's no immediate conflicts of interest here. So everybody's happy.
Well, Comcast was very upset with Fox because they said, look, we came in and we offered you more money than what Disney was offering. And you basically shot us down, you know, no questions asked. And I don't think your shareholders would appreciate that. We're going to make life tough for you overseas. I think that's what's going on here. I don't know necessarily whether Comcast really wants Sky.
Well, no. You think they're just doing this for fun, just to be annoying?
No. I don't think
you make a bid for Sky unless you seriously want it.
I think they actually see an opportunity, too.
Yeah, this isn't Mean Girls.
Mean Girl. Could you
Good
imagine?
God. Yeah. I think the Fox buying of Sky is dead.
Yeah, I think so too. I think you can't turn down a 16% premium at a time when the actual other bid is probably, well, may not go through. So
yeah, so I guess that Fox attempt to buy Sky is dead and buried.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying that
teeing
maybe
you up, dude.
Okay, yeah. Sometimes, you know, you give me these softballs and I'm like, oh, we're playing softball? I did not realize that. Where's my bat? Where's my glove? And for those of you outside of North America,
people have heard of softball. We're moving to the obituary section where we're talking about David Ogden Stiers of MASH, the one of the stars of the most famous sitcom of all time. Are you now going to explain what MASH is to people around the world? It's a sitcom in America set during the Korean War, but in fact, really reflecting our current involvement in Vietnam. It's like, yes, we've heard of MASH, but David Ogden Stiers stepped into the show in the sixth season, I think, to play the new foil for Hawkeye and BJ. Larry Farrell, is that how you say his name? Yeah. The guy who played Major Frank Burns left the show, bad idea, and they wanted somebody new for them to play off of, but it had to be somebody different, of course. They didn't want to repeat themselves. So in came David Ogden Stiers playing this Boston sophisticate. He loved classical music. He was smart. He was a great surgeon, maybe even better than Hawkeye and BJ. And he could prank as good as they could. So they were suddenly had a whole different dynamic than sort of the sad sack Frank Burns. And it was a really fun way to shake up the show. And that's what a great sitcom does when they run a long time, like The Mary Tyler Moore Show or MASH. If you want to stay fresh, you have to bring in new people. All in the Family did it. You got in new characters, new people who were very different, and they shook up the show. It's really hard to have the same people for like 8-10 years and not have it get really, really repetitive. That's what you see happening on like The Big Bang Theory or Friends or lots of shows. In this case, they brought in a bunch of new people, and it really kept the show fresh. So he played Charles Emerson Winchester III, but he played lots of other people too. He did a lot of voiceover work, including Cogsworth in the animated film Beauty and the Beast.
That's what he might best be known for to a whole generation of, well, now millennials.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And he did lots of voice work for Disney, which is one reason why he didn't come out until 2009. He was worried it would hurt his career in family-friendly movies. Not that most people would have known or cared, but he finally felt free about a decade ago to come out. So that was kind of cool. So he spent the last 9 years of his life living openly. He died March 3rd from bladder cancer. His first screen credit actually was voiceover work. It was as the narrator in George Lucas's THX 1138. And he had pretty good timing. He died March 3rd. And I was just reading in, I think, the Hollywood Reporter, an oral history of MASH. They had a couple different stories where they interviewed everyone to celebrate the last episode. That aired on February 28th, 1983. That was 35 years ago. So everybody was in there talking about the ending of the show and what it meant to them. So it was a good, you know, just the 35th anniversary of that show coming to a close. And, you know, he got to have one last little hurrah in the spotlight.
Well, that's the end of us shining a spotlight on the entertainment business, as we do every single week here on Showbiz Sandbox. In fact, if you don't want to miss an episode, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, or Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us, rate and review us. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to follow us at showbizsandbox on Twitter or facebook.com/showbizsandbox on the Facebook. You can also Email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You like the way I called Facebook, the Facebook, the original?
I did. It was very clever.
Yeah, it's old school. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Their new album, by the way, just dropped and can be streamed or purchased pretty much everywhere. Tickets for their world tour are on sale now, and they hit the U.S. beginning, well, this month, March. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, well, he's got his own website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Jimmy Kimmel is not JohnnyCarson.com.
Oh, my goodness. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage on that website, or even find that website, why not head on over to MichaelGiltz.com, where all of his writing about the entertainment industry is aggregated, or, of course, you should always check out BookFilter.com. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. And until next week, I leave you with these two words. Play nice.
Oh my God, you fooled me. I thought it was going to be inclusion rider. I thought you were going to pull a Frances McDormand on me. Very nice.
That's what it was referencing.
Good job.